Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on War is a Racket, right after this. You know, here's an interesting statement. It says, "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men." You read that statement in Acts 5, verse 29. It's a revolutionary concept if you stop and think about it. We ought to obey God rather than men. But you know, that's impossible to put into practice unless you personally know the law yourself. Now, can you imagine yourself actually telling a policeman or a judge that the law of God supersedes the law of the state? And yet there are actually three laws that support Peter's position in Acts 5, verse 29. The First Amendment to our Constitution is number one. Congress enacted Public Law 97-280. That's the second. And the Supreme Court seconded that motion in a case called Seeger versus United States. That's the third source of authority. Now, do you know the scriptural law to cite in support of your position, say on the census or public school, social security, vaccinations, or the many other laws of the scripture that conflict with the laws of the state? Do you know how to look it up? Do you know how to search it out? Do you know how to code plead the law to use the scripture to defend yourself and your position against state and federal attack? Now, if you don't know the law of Scripture and you don't know the law of the state, then you're in no position to challenge either one. So if you're tired of being a biblical illiterate with the police and the public officials kicking sand in your face, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the first place. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about three-star Marine General Smedley Butler. Three-star general. Spent 32 years in the military. He came to a conclusion in 1935, and he wrote a little book. This book, you can probably get at Barnes & Noble. That's where I bought this one. Probably 10 or 15 bucks. It might not even be that. I didn't pay for it. The wife did. It's a little booklet. It's probably 60, 70 pages. It might only be $3 or $4. But it really is an eye-opener because unless you hear from an insider, you're not going to get the straight skinny. You can't get the straight skinny out of any institution from their public statements. CBS tells you all the bright things about CBS. They don't tell you about the skullduggery that goes on behind the scenes. And neither do the government agencies, and neither does the American Cancer Society, the American Medical Society or Association. But once in a while, some guy from the inside of these institutions, it could be the Department of Agriculture or the Department of, or the FDA or from the Defense Department or somebody else, and they'll come out and say, listen, do you know what's going on in here? And Butler's just one of those. So from the point of view of a three-star general who says war is a racket, then he identifies the racketeers and who's making the money and who's paying the bills. I think it's well worth the 10 or 15 bucks for the book. Now, last time we were talking about the dollars and cents costs that war inflicts upon Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives. We pay all the bills, and Halliburton and Bechtel make all the profits. And then there's your sons and your daughters getting killed or maimed in the process, and it's being done in the name of prophets. There isn't any intelligent or logical reason for us to be fighting in Iraq. There's a reason for being there, and it's profit, it's money, it makes a lot of money. There's all kinds of good reasons for being there, but there's nothing that's intelligent or logical. Not from the perspective of the majority of Americans, there isn't. And I showed you that last time. In fact, I went back to the Spanish-American War in 1898, before America owned any foreign territories, any territory outside of our own borders, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Cuba. Before that came about, we didn't own anything outside of our borders over here, and then we became a colonial power, kind of overnight. The Spanish-American War didn't take us very long. We became a colonial power, and we spent $600 million on the Philippines in 35 years and made $200 million in return. Now, that's a $400 million loss. So we had to pay that $400 million loss out of our profits that we were making here in the United States to start with. Had we never gotten involved with the Philippines to start with, we would have been $600 million, or in this case, $400 million richer. Now, we had a lot of money that we could throw away and burn, and we did. And then we got involved in World War II, and we spent billions more on the Philippines, and then turned around and gave it to the Filipinos. Now, that wasn't a very profitable adventure at all. And the point that Mr. Butler is making is that these foreign wars make a lot of money for multinational corporations at our expense. For you and I, the average Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife down here at the bottom tier of the pyramid, we'd be better off if we just stayed the hell out of it and minded our own business. But we get excited. And when the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, boy, people got excited. And when the Al-Qaeda guys attacked the trade towers on 9/11, we got excited. And a football player by the name of Tillman, he got excited, ran off, and he joined the army. Then he went over and got himself killed. Well, okay. But what did that gain him? And now, but 3 years later, we take a look at the war, and even the American people, who were all in favor of the war, 3 or 4 years ago, changed their minds. Say, hey, this thing isn't worth it. And that's right. And it isn't worth it in dollars and cents. And we're not going to get the oil that we went over there to steal anyway. When it's all said and done, we're going to end up paying for it. But the worst part of it was, if we'd have stayed home, minded our own business, and done absolutely nothing, that oil in Iraq would cost us $60 a barrel. After we went over there and fought and bled and died and went through all of this agony, it's going to cost us $120 a barrel. Now, somebody's going to make a lot of money off of this war, there's no doubt about it, but it's not you and I. And we're still going to pay that $120 a barrel. I don't think that that makes any sense. Not that war, from time to time, doesn't make sense. There might be a time or two when you need to go to war. I'm not a pacifist. But I can't see that World War I benefited any Americans, or that World War II benefited any Americans, or that Korea or Vietnam or Iraq has benefited any Americans. Now, at least not Americans that are down here at the local level. Now, there might be some Americans on Wall Street or in the Pentagon or maybe in some multinational corporation like Halliburton. It benefited them, but, you know, for every guy that benefits, there's a million of us that don't. Now, take a look at this. Then to save the China trade. This is back now in the World War I period. To save that China trade, $90 million, or to protect these private investments of $200 million in the Philippines, we would all get stirred up to hate Japan and go to war, a war that might well cost us tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of lives of Americans, and many more hundreds of thousands of physically maimed and mentally unbalanced men. Now, that's what he said in 1935. I'm going to make a little note here in the margin. And then in 1941, that's precisely what we did. Over this $290 million worth of investment and trade, we went to war against Japan, spent multiple billions of dollars. Hey, we won the war. We beat their pants off. But when we got all through, we didn't make a quarter on the transaction, and we'd have been better off and lives ahead, and we'd all felt better if we'd have left it alone. And, of course, for this loss, there would be compensating profit. Fortunes were made. Millions and billions of dollars would be piled up by a few munitions makers, shipbuilders, manufacturers, meat packers, and speculators. They would all fare very well. World War II, World War I paid well for a few. Yes, they're getting ready for another war. Why shouldn't they? It pays high dividends. But what does it profit the masses? What does it profit the men who are killed? What does it profit the men who are maimed? What does it profit their mothers and sisters, their wives and their sweethearts? What does it profit their children? What does it profit anyone except the very few to whom war means huge profits? On Wall Street, or in the Pentagon, or in the government halls of Congress. Yes, and what does it profit the nation? Take our own case. You know, until 1898, we Americans didn't own a bit of territory outside of mainland North America. And at that time, our national debt was about $1 billion. Then we became internationally minded, and we forgot, or else we shunted aside the advice of George Washington, the father of our country. We forgot Washington's warning message in his farewell address about entangling alliances. So we went to war, and we acquired outside territory. And at the end of the war, that's the World War I period, as a direct result of our fiddling in international affairs, our national debt had jumped to over $25 billion. Therefore, on a purely financial bookkeeping basis, we ran a little behind year for year, and that foreign trade might well have been ours without those wars. And it would have been far cheaper, not to say a whole lot safer, for the average Joe Sixpack American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few people, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people. And it's the people who do not profit. So let's tuck that one away in our hearts. This is a guy by the name of Smedley Butler, 3-star Marine Corps general, 1935. Now, he was in the military from about 1900 to 1932. And he's an insider. And he says a little later in the book, we'll see a few of his quotations, he says he was working for Brown Brothers and Harriman and the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgan and United Fruit Company, and a whole host and plethora of other corporations in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, and other Haiti and a couple other countries, protecting those business interests. Protecting those business interests. But what does that benefit you and I? Now, when we translate this man's work in 1935 to where we are in 2006, this guy could have written this book last week. And it would be just as on point if he'd have written the book in 2006 as it was when he wrote it in 1935. And this war thing, which he calls a racket, has been working for thousands of years. It's working today, and it will continue to work as long as mankind is out there buying, selling, and trading, and making profit in war. We've been doing it for thousands of years. I imagine we'll continue to do that. But you ought to be aware that the next time somebody says, hey, let's go to war against Iran, hey, let's go to war against North Korea, you ought to ask yourself, well, what did the North Koreans do that would get me all excited and want to go to war? The Vietnam War was triggered by what's known as the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. It was one of these black flag operations, false flag operations, in which our side phonied up this attack and then blamed it on the North Vietnamese to give us the justification and the excuse to go to war. So we did, and we spent $100 billion in the process and then lost. Boys and girls, we didn't need to spend $100 billion to lose. Hell, we could have just stayed at home, minded our own business, and the exact same outcome that you see there in Southeast Asia today would have been the exact same outcome, except we'd have $100 billion more money, and 58,000 more people wouldn't have died. That's all. Now, who is it that's making all these war profits? You ever stop and wonder about that? Who makes these war profits? Who are these thousands of new millionaires and billionaires that are created by these wars? Well, World War I, rather our brief participation in World War I, has cost the United States $52 billion. So you go figure. That means $400 to every American man, woman, and child as of 1935, and we haven't paid that debt yet, and we're still paying for it, and our children are going to continue to pay for it, and our children's children's children, probably, will still be paying the cost of that war for generations to come. The normal profits of a normal business concern here in the United States is about 6, 8, 10, and sometimes even 12%. But wartime profits, oh, now that's another matter. 20%, 60%, 100%, 300%, and even 1,800% profit on these wartime industries. The sky is the limit. All that the traffic will bear, and Uncle Sam has the money, so let's get at it. Now, of course, it isn't put that crudely in wartime. It's dressed up in speeches about patriotism and love of country. And we must all put our shoulders to the wheel. But the profits jump and leap and skyrocket and are safely pocketed. So let's just take a few examples. Let's take a look at our friend the DuPonts. The DuPonts, the powder people. Didn't one of them testify before a Senate committee recently that their powder won the war? Or something like that. Well, how did the DuPonts do in the war? How did they make out? Well, they were a very patriotic corporation, a very patriotic family, and the average earnings of the DuPonts for the period 1910 to 1914 was $6 million a year. It wasn't much, but the DuPonts managed to get along on it, $6 million a year. Now let's take a look at their average yearly profit during the war years of 1914 to 1918. $58 million a year profit for the four-year period. Now that's nearly 10 times that of normal times, and the profits of normal times were pretty good. It's an increase in profits of more than 950%. Now think about that, and then ask yourself, boys and girls, why is it that this corporation, called the DuPont Corporation, is making 10 times more during the war than they were making before the war? Why wouldn't it be satisfactory for them to continue on making more money, but why do they have to make 10 times more money? I don't know how much is reasonable. But it would seem like to me that if you're making $1 million a year and you're selling your products, and then next year there's a war and we make $10 million, it would seem like to me that that's a little bit out of proportion, since the rest of the society, the rest of the people over here aren't making 10 times more money, are they? Is the guy that's making the powder working in the DuPont factory, does he get paid 10 times more? Does the soldier out on the front line, does he get paid 10 times more? Well, why is it then that the corporations make 10 times more money during wartime, but the soldiers that are fighting at the front, they don't get paid 10 times more? And the defense workers back at home making the armaments for the war, they're not getting 10 times more. Why is that? Would seem like to me that if war is so profitable and it's so good, that we ought to share the wealth, that the soldiers ought to be getting 10 times more and the defense workers ought to be getting 10 times more, it seemed like to me, just to be fair. Take a look at the steel companies. The steel companies, remember, that so patriotically shunted aside the making of rails and girders and bridges to manufacture all this war material. Well, their 1910 to 14 yearly earnings averaged $6 million a year, same as the DuPonts. Then came the war. And like loyal citizens, Bethlehem Steel promptly turned to munitions making. Well, did their profits jump, or did they let Uncle Sam in for a bargain? Well, again, their 1914 to 19 average was $49 million a year. That's eight times more money. Or let's take a look at United States Steel. The normal earnings during the five-year period prior to the war were $105 million a year. That's not bad. Then along came the war, and up went their profits. The average yearly profit for the period 1914 to 1918 was $240 million. So it's more than double. And there you have some of the steel and powder earnings. Now let's look at something else, a little copper perhaps. Copper always does well in war times. Anaconda copper. For instance, the average yearly earnings during the pre-war years of 1910 to 1914 were $10 million a year. Along comes World War I, and during the war years 1914 to 1918, their profits leaped to $34 million a year, three times more. Or Utah copper, their average of $5 million per year during the 1910 to 14 period jumped to an average of $21 million a year, four times as much. Now let's group these five with three smaller companies, and the total yearly average profits of the pre-war period from 1910 to 1914 were $137 million. Then along comes the war, and the yearly average profits for this group skyrocket to $408 million, about four times more. Now, wouldn't you think that during wartime, these corporations and these businesses ought to put their shoulder to the wheel like the soldiers and the defense workers and the citizens paying the taxes and all pull their fair share so that no one unfairly profits from this mutual enterprise of war for the benefit of all? Take a look at Utah Copper Company. The average of $5 million a year during the 1910 to 14 jumps to $21 million. Now, you take a look here, they made four times more during the war than they did in the years prior to the war. Evidently, they were doing all right prior to the war. Wouldn't it be fair then for these people to hold their profit margins down? In other words, instead of jacking the prices up because there's this war emergency and taking advantage of everybody, wouldn't it be better if they restrained themselves and did their part for the war effort? Wouldn't it be kind of neat if Halliburton and Bechtel went over to Iraq for the benefit of the American people and the benefit of the Iraqi people, and made the same profit that they were making before the war or without the war? Why should they jack their prices up? Why should the government award no-bid contracts to Halliburton? Why can't they bid on them with other companies and let us take the low bidder? I mean, wouldn't that be reasonable? It's the way we used to do business. It's the way normal people do business to this day. I mean, you don't take your car in to, you know, you've had an accident, you take your car in to the shop and then the insurance company says, oh, we'll just take a no-bid contract. Just go ahead and fix it and send us the bill. Don't they want to have an estimate in writing? Don't they want you to take this to three shops so that we can get the lowest bidder? Isn't that the way normal people do business? What's this no-bid contract stuff coming out of our government today with this war in Iraq? Huh? What's that all about? Well, a little increase in profits of approximately 200%. Well, does war pay? Well, it paid them, and it paid them well. But they're not the only ones. There are still others. So let's take leather. For the three-year period before the war, the total profits of the Central Leather Company were $3.5 million. Now, that's about $1,167,000 a year. So in 1916, Central Leather returned a profit of $15,500,000. That's about, in round numbers, about 15 times more money. a small increase of 1,100%. That's all. And the General Chemical Company averaged a profit for the 3 years before the war of a little over $800,000 a year. Then the war comes along and their profits jump to $12 million a year, a leap of 1,400%. International Nickel Company, and you can't have a war without nickel, you know, showed an increase in profits from a mere average of $4 million a year to $73 million a year. Not bad. It's an increase of 1,700%. American Sugar Refining Company averaged $200,000 a year for the 3 years before the war. In 1916, they made a profit of $6 million. Listen to Senate Document Number 259. Come out of the 65th Congress. Reporting on corporate earnings and government revenues. Considering the profits of 122 meat packers, 153 cotton manufacturers, 299 garment makers, 49 steel plants, and 340 coal producers during the war. Profits under 25% were exceptional. For instance, the coal companies made between 100% and 7,856% on their capital stock during the war. The Chicago meat packers doubled and tripled their earnings. And let us not forget the bankers who financed this great war. If anyone had the cream of the profits, it was the bankers. Being partnerships rather than incorporated organizations, they do not have to report to stockholders, and their profits were as secret as they were immense. How the bankers made their millions and their billions, I do not know, because those little secrets never become public. Even before the Senate investigating subcommittee, it doesn't become public. But here's how some of the other patriotic industrialists and speculators chiseled their way into war profits. Take the shoe people. Shoe manufacturers like war. Because it brings business with abnormal profits. And they made huge profits on sales abroad to our allies. Perhaps like the munitions and manufacturers and armament makers, they also sold to the enemy, as well as to selling to us. For a dollar is a dollar, whether it comes from Germany, France, or the United States. But they did well by Uncle Sam, too. For instance, they sold Uncle Sam 35 million pairs of hobnailed service shoes. There were 4 million soldiers. Now, 8 pairs and more to a soldier. Well, my regiment during the war had only 1 pair of shoes to a soldier. And some of these shoes probably are still in existence. They were very good shoes. But when the war was over, Uncle Sam had a matter of 25 million pairs left over, bought and paid for, profits recorded and pocketed. And there are still lots of leather left, so the leather people sold Uncle Sam hundreds of thousands of McClellan saddles for the cavalry. But there wasn't any American cavalry overseas. Somebody had to get rid of this leather. However, somebody had to make a profit on it. So we had a lot of those McClellan saddles, and we probably have a lot of them left yet. And also, somebody had a lot of mosquito netting. They sold our government 20 million mosquito nets for the use of our soldiers overseas. I suppose that the boys were expected to put it over them as they tried to sleep in the muddy trenches, one hand scratching cooties on their backs and the other making passes at scurrying rats. Well, not one of those mosquito nets ever got to France. I never saw them. My men never saw them. Anyhow, these thoughtful manufacturers wanted to make sure that no soldier would be without his mosquito net, so 40 million additional yards of mosquito netting were sold to our government. And there were pretty good profits in mosquito netting in war days, and even if there were no mosquitoes in France, they still made the profits, and our boys never saw a single mosquito net. Let me pause right there, put an arrow in the margin, and point out, have you heard anything in the news about that kind of graft and corruption going on in Iraq? My God, it goes on every day. They lost $9 billion over there. Cash! $9 billion in cash! $100 bills, lost it. or passed it out as bribes, or it was stolen by the Iraqis or the Iraqi government or somebody. You know, when you're spending $100 billion a year, 9%, that's $9 billion, that's 9% of the money. And then that was just taken in the last 6 or 8 months. Just disappeared and nobody knows what happened to it. Does that benefit the 3,000 guys that are dead, or the 8 or 10,000 guys that are crippled up, or the 100,000 Iraqis that have been killed and tens of thousands that are injured? How does that benefit any of those people out there? I know war is necessary. We couldn't live without it, and our economy would probably collapse if we didn't have this war going. But is there a better way? Is there something that we could do differently than avoid the war? Well, Smedley Butler thinks there is. Smedley Butler, the World War I, three-star general, has more to say on war as a racket when we come back. In the meantime, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And if you'd like more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, our schedule, and archives that can be accessed through the webpage. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed, or typically isn't totally endorsed, by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you do hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, the book we're reviewing here is three-star Marine General Smedley Butler's book, War is a Racket. I got this one at Barnes & Noble. It's also published by, if I can find the page here, published by an outfit called FerrellHouse.com, FerrellHouse. If you go to www.FerrellHouse.com, you know, webpage, or you can send them an email at info@FerrellHouse.com. That's all one word, FerrellHouse. Or you can write to them at Farrell House, P.O. Box 39910. That's 39910, Post Office Box 39910, Los Angeles, California, 90039. That's Los Angeles, California, 90039. War is a Racket, General Smedley Butler. Now, he's written a number of other books. Common Sense Neutrality, An Amendment for Peace, and The Horror of It. War is a Racket, Major General Smedley Butler, Common Sense Neutrality, page 47, An Amendment for Peace. We'll cover some of these as we progress along. Smedley Butler wrote his thoughts, his memoirs here in 1935. He said there were pretty good profits in mosquito netting in the war days, even if there were no mosquitoes in France. I suppose if the war had lasted just a little longer, the enterprising mosquito netting manufacturers would have sold your Uncle Sam a couple of consignments of mosquitoes so that they could plant mosquitoes in France, so that we'd have a need for the mosquito nets, so that more mosquito netting would be in order, so that they could sell more mosquito netting to fight off the mosquitoes that they themselves had brought to France. But the war didn't last long enough to do that. The airplane and engine manufacturers felt that they too should get their just profits out of this war, and why not? Everybody else was getting theirs, so $1 billion, $1 billion, count them if you live long enough, $1 billion was spent by our government in building airplanes and airplane engines that never left the ground. Not one plane or motor out of the billions of dollars worth ordered ever got into a battle in France. Just to name the manufacturers made their little profit of, just the same, the manufacturers made their little profit of 30, 100, and in some cases 300% profit. Undershirts for soldiers cost 14 cents to make, and the United States government paid 30 cents to 40 cents each for them, a nice little profit for the undershirt manufacturers, and the stocking manufacturers, and the uniform manufacturers, and the cap manufacturers, and the steel helmet manufacturers, they all got theirs too. Why? Well, when the war was over, some 4 million sets of equipment, knapsacks and the things that go to fill them, crammed warehouses on this side of the Atlantic. Now they're being scrapped because the regulations have changed the contents. But the manufacturers collected their wartime profits on them anyway, and they'll do it all over again the next time in the next war. And there were lots of brilliant ideas for profit-making during the last war also. And one very versatile patriot sold Uncle Sam 12 dozen 48-inch wrenches. Oh, I'm not complaining about the quality of the wrenches. They were very nice wrenches. The only trouble was that there was only one nut that's ever been made that was large enough for these wrenches. And that's the one that holds the turbines at Niagara Falls, New York. So after Uncle Sam had bought them and the manufacturer, remember this is 12 dozen 48-inch wrenches. There aren't very many 48-inch nuts. So when the armistice was signed, it was indeed a sad blow to the wrench manufacturer. He was just about to make some nuts to fit the wrenches and then sell the nuts to the government so that they would have wrenches to fit the nuts or nuts to fit the wrenches. Then he planned to sell those too to guess who? That is your government, Uncle Sam. Still another had the brilliant idea that colonels shouldn't ride in automobiles, nor should they even ride horseback. One had probably seen a picture of Andy Jackson riding on a buckboard. Well, 6,000 buckboards were sold to the government during the big war for the use of these colonels, but not one of them was ever used. But the buckboard manufacturer got his windfall war profit. The shipbuilders felt that they should come out on top of it, and some of them, too, got in on the act. They built a lot of ships, and they made a lot of profit. More than $3 billion worth of profits, and some of the ships were all right, but $635 million worth were made of wood, wood that wouldn't float, and the seams opened up, and these wooden ships sank. We paid for them. We paid for all of them, and somebody else pocketed the profits. And it's been estimated by statisticians and economists and researchers that the war has cost Uncle Sam $52 billion. Of this sum, $39 billion was expended in the actual war period. This expenditure yielded $16 billion in profits. That is how the 21,000 millionaires and billionaires got to be millionaires and billionaires. And this $16 billion in profits is not to be sneezed at. It's quite a tidy sum. And it went to a very few people in America. The Senate, in the Nye Committee probe of the munitions industry and its wartime profits, despite its sensational disclosures, hardly has scratched the surface as of this date in 1935. And even so, it has had some effect. The State Department has been studying for some time methods of keeping out of war. The War Department suddenly decides it has a wonderful plan to spring. The administration names a committee, with the War and Navy Departments ably represented under the chairmanship of a Wall Street speculator, to limit profits in wartime. To what extent isn't suggested? Well, possibly the profits of 3, 6, or 1600% of those who turned blood into gold in World War I would be limited to some smaller figure. Apparently, however, the plan does not call for any limitation of losses. That is, the losses of those who fight the war. That's the people that are actually getting killed and maimed in the war. And as far as I've been able to ascertain, there's nothing in the scheme to limit a soldier to the loss of one eye, or to the loss of one arm, or to limit his wounds to one or two or three, or to limit the loss of life. My friends, there's nothing in this scheme, apparently, that says not more than 12% of a regiment shall be wounded in battle, or not more than 7% in a division should be killed. Of course, the committee cannot be bothered with such trifling matters. Now that's chapter 2. Speaking of who is profiting, shipbuilders profit, munitions manufacturers, the Boeing Company, Lockheed Martin, Bechtel, Halliburton, Kellogg Brown and Root. These are the big names that you see splashed in the newspaper headlines day after day. The people that are taking these windfall profits in no bid contracts, or who are screwing, bluing, and tattooing every taxpayer in America with their shoddy workmanship and their non-delivery or their out-and-out thefts. But hey, listen, there's nothing going on in this war in Iraq that hasn't gone on in the war in Vietnam, or the war in Korea, or World War II, or World War I, or for that matter, in our American Civil War. Wars are immensely profitable. In fact, in our war economy, here in America, we need war. We need war. From time to time, it stimulates our economy. It's a part and parcel of who we are and what we are. And that's where reality is located. Butler has raised a red flag and said, but why are we doing this? Does it really make a lot of sense? Now, in the excitement of 9/11, we were sitting here saying, you know, we got to get even with these guys. In fact, if it's possible, we'd like to get a little bit ahead. Now, take a look at the direct costs. I mean, honor is worth something. I'm not denying that. I mean, you can't just have somebody come up and slap you up alongside the head, and then we don't do anything about that. But what we did about it was to swat a camel with a fly swatter. Or maybe it's worse, you know, maybe we're swatting a mosquito, you know, with a sledgehammer. Is it really that necessary? Are we going to get any semblance of value out of the expenditures that we're making? Well, in the last program, I pointed out to you that the entire country of Iraq holds about 25% of the world's known oil supplies. That's about, out of a trillion barrels, about 250 billion barrels. There's about a trillion barrels of oil worldwide. proven reserves, and the Iraqis have 25% of them. And I showed you that at $60 a barrel, that would be about $2.5 trillion. And the estimated cost of the Iraqi war will run as high as $2 trillion. And the low-end figure is $1. Now, I don't know whether it's going to be $2 trillion or $1 trillion, but it's going to be something in between. And the longer you stay, the more it's going to cost. Now, if we were actually going to get that oil over there, I guess we could justify spending $2 trillion to get $2.5 trillion worth of oil. But it looks like to me, from where I'm sitting over here today and looking at the news, and the news is reporting, that the Iraqis are importing oil from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait because they can't produce enough there for themselves. Now, this Saddam Hussein guy was probably a pretty bad guy. I wouldn't deny that. But you know, there's got to be a limit to how much money you spend, and the American people in the last election, I guess, have just about had a bellyful. My question is, why couldn't you have thought of that in 2003? Did you think this war was going to cost $50 billion and we were going to take it out of the Iraqi oil sales? I mean, that's what we were sold. But isn't that the way they sell these wars every time? They tell us it's going to cost a dime and it costs us a dollar. I guess we can't learn from history. We didn't learn from World War I. That's why I thought that maybe we could learn something here. As they get us all excited about going to war with North Korea and with Iran, that maybe we ought to moderate that a little bit and say, well, let's see, when was the last time the North Koreans attacked California, Washington, or Oregon? And I suppose our response to the North Koreans ought to be in measure, but you know, since they haven't attacked us, and I'm sitting over here saying, you know, what difference does it make to us if they've got nukes? Now, if they were to drop a nuke, I thought Bill Clinton's response the other day was pretty good. He was being interviewed, I don't know, by Larry King or somebody. And they were talking about the North Korean nukes, and Clinton said, well, all I can say about North Korea dropping a nuclear weapon on the United States, the day that they do that, the best day in North Korea's history will have been the day before that. I thought that was a pretty apt response. Because I would guess that if the North Koreans could drop a nuke on Los Angeles or Seattle, that the response that we might give might put them back in the Stone Age, or maybe a little before that, within a day or two. And I think that would be a pretty apt response. But is it necessary to go over there and get involved in a 3-5 year long ground war in the process? I mean, couldn't you just go nuke them back into the Stone Age and then come back home? I think that the best part of the war with Iraq was when you went over there and destroyed their army, destroyed everything they had, and then if we'd have packed up and come back home, we could have been saying today, now listen, you Iranians over there, did you see what we did to the Iraqis? Now wake up and pay attention. You know, at that point in time, we could be saying to the North Koreans, hey, did you see what we did to the Iraqis? Now wake up and pay attention. And today, you got no credibility. You're a defeated army over in Iraq. Defeated by a bunch of ragheads running around with IUDs or IEDs, whichever you want to call them. And if you're saying now that we're not defeated over there, what do you call that, huh? The world's most powerful army fought to a standstill by how many? I think they got 12,000 fighters. Some guy said the other day that they got 12,000. We got 160,000 men on the ground over there, plus another 175,000 Iraqis that we're training and putting on the ground. And these 12,000, let's see, what's 160? 160 plus 175 is a 335,000 men army. Fought to a standstill by 12,000 insurgents, and you call that victory? Huh? Huh? Come on, kids. Come on, kids. You're getting waxed over there. That's what it boils down to, and I don't think that's a very good place to be. Now, Smedley Butler comes up with another side to the coin. He says, who pays these bills? Who's going to pay for that Iraq war? Do you think it's going to be Halliburton, Bechtel? The guys that stole the $9 billion over there in Iraq? I mean, come on, guys. Who's going to be paying it? Well, who provides the profits? Well, these nice little profits, 20, 100, 300, 15, 1,800%, well, we all pay them. And we pay them in taxation. Or we pay them in inflation. We paid the bankers their profits when we bought Liberty bonds at $100 a bond and then sold them back to the bankers for $84. These bankers collected $100 plus. It was a simple manipulation that the bankers engineered. The bankers controlled the security markets. It was easy for them to depress the price of these bonds. Then all of us, the little people, got frightened and we sold our bonds for $84. The bankers rushed out and bought the bonds for $84. Then these same bankers stimulated a boom and government bonds went to par, $100 and above, and the bankers collected their profits. So the bankers who lobby for the wars profit off of the war by selling us the bonds, and then we buy the bonds, and then they come back and buy the bonds from us and make a second profit off of them. But the soldier pays the biggest part of the bill. And if you don't believe this, then visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad. Or visit any of our veterans' hospitals here in the United States. On a tour of our country, in the midst of which I am at the time of this writing, I have visited 18 government hospitals for veterans. In these hospitals, there's a total of 50,000 destroyed men. Men who were the pick of the nation 18 years ago. The very able chief surgeon of the U.S. Government Hospital in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where there are 3,800 of these living dead men, told me that mortality among veterans is three times as great as among those who stayed at home. Now take a look at the first Gulf War. We sent about 500,000 men over there. And those guys came back with a malady called Gulf War Syndrome. Nobody remembers that now, and our government isn't paying for it. You can rest assured that billions of dollars in profits were made by our multinational corporations. And the death rate among these soldiers is three times the national average, which is exactly what it was back in 1935 when Smedley Butler was going around to the veterans' hospitals. And he says, Jesus, guys, these veterans are dying at a rate three times greater than the general population. Why is that? Why is that? Is it their war wounds? Does anybody care? Now, the one thing that can be said about the war today is that all of these veterans today coming back from the war are volunteers. Nobody coerced them, you know. Nobody said, hey, we're going to stick a gun to your head, sign here. Now, boys with a normal viewpoint are taken out of the fields and offices and factories and classrooms, and then they're put into the ranks of the military. It is there in the military that they are remolded. And it is there that these young boys are made over. They were made to about face, to regard murder as the order of the day. In total disregard of thou shalt do no murder, they were taught that murder is the order of the day, and they were put shoulder to shoulder and put through mass psychology. And they were entirely changed. We used them for 2 years and trained them to think nothing at all of killing or being killed. Then the war ended. And suddenly we discharged all of them back into the civilian society. And we told them to make another about face. This time they had to do their own readjusting. Sans mass psychology, sans officers, aid and advice, sans nationwide propaganda, we didn't need them anymore. So we scattered them about without any 3-minute or Liberty Loan speeches or parades. We just cut them loose and sent them home. Many, too many of these fine young boys are eventually destroyed. They're destroyed mentally because they could not make that final about face alone. In the government hospital in Marion, Indiana, 1,800 of these boys are in pens, locked up in pens. 500 of them in a barracks with steel bars and wires all around outside the buildings and on the porches. These men already have been mentally destroyed. These boys don't even look like human beings. Oh, the looks on their faces. Physically, they're in good shape. Mentally, they're basket cases. They're gone. There are thousands and thousands of these cases, and more are coming in all the time. The tremendous excitement of the war, the sudden cutting off of the excitement, the young boys just couldn't stand it. That's part of the bill. So much for the dead. They have paid their part of the war profits. So much for the mentally and physically wounded. They are paying now their share for these war profits. But the others paid too. They paid with heartbreaks when they tore themselves away from their firesides and their families to don the uniform of the United States, on which a profit had to be made. They paid another part in the training camps where they were regimented and drilled, while others took their jobs on the home front and their places in their lives in their communities. They paid for it in the trenches where they shot and were shot, where they went hungry for days at a time, where they slept in the mud and in the cold and in the rain with the moans and the shrieks of the dying for a horrible lullaby. But don't forget, the soldiers paid part of the dollars and cents bill too. Up to and including the Spanish-American War, we had a prize system and soldiers and sailors fought for prize money. Prize money. During the Civil War, they were paid bonuses, and in many instances, before they went into service, the government of the states paid as high as $1,200 for a single enlistment. In the Spanish-American War, they gave prize money. When we captured the vessels of the enemy, the soldiers all got their share. At least they were supposed to. Then it was found that they could reduce the cost of wars by taking all the prize money and keeping it, but conscripting the soldiers anyway. And then the soldiers couldn't bargain for their labor, and everyone else could bargain, but the soldiers couldn't. Isn't that what's going on today and over in Iraq? I don't know what these soldiers are getting paid over in Iraq, but is it worth it? Are you soldiers over there getting paid what it's worth? Halliburton is paying upwards of $100,000 for truck drivers over there to drive trucks back and forth. How much are those soldiers getting paid? The mercenaries that are being sent over there, hired and recruited from around the world to do various jobs, they're getting paid $100,000 a year. The lowest pay I know of is $80,000. Any of you soldiers over there getting paid that kind of money to get shot at? Hey, boys and girls, nothing's changed in Iraq today. It hasn't changed in World War II, World War I, the Spanish-American War. Things are always the same. And the big corporations make the big profits, and you don't see their sons and their daughters going to war. Hey, I got to leave it right here. We'll remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. All of these law or programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Hey, our time's about up. I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.